Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Now, in the middle of his tour of Africa, President Bush swooped through Botswana today, reaffirming his pledge to help Africa fight AIDS and debilitating poverty. The U.S. commitment to Africa appears stronger than ever. But Columbia University's global economy guru Jeffrey Sachs says, wait, much more could be done, and done by just a few rich Americans. So should it? Tonight on Point, a rich country, a poor continent, and a modest proposal for change. We begin in Pretoria, South Africa, where President Bush is spending the night. Tamara Lipper is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine and is traveling with the president. I asked her how the trip has been going from the White House perspective.
The White House is very pleased with the president's trip so far. He's made three stops now, starting in Senegal and West Africa, continuing on to South Africa, and finishes today with a trip to Botswana. And each of the stops, he's been able to highlight a specific part of his agenda. And the White House seems very pleased that its messages, its kind of multifaceted messages, are getting out on AIDS, on democracy, and on economic development for Africa.
And how is the president being received by Africans, by the heads of state he's meeting with, by Africans at large, I guess, as represented in newspaper response?
Well, the president's response has been varied from what we can tell in the places he's been. Today in Botswana, he clearly got the warmest response he's had so far on the street, both from President Lohai of Botswana, who is a steadfast ally of the president and the White House in the war on terror, increasingly in the fight against AIDS, and is sort of the shining example President Bush hopes to illustrate of a successful democracy here in Africa. But more importantly, perhaps, the president was warmly received by the local people in Botswana who came out of their homes and their places of work to line the roads and watch his motorcade go by. That's something we haven't seen in other stops in Senegal and in South Africa in particular, where, in fact, there were some protests here in South Africa, where I am now, for the president's position in Iraq in particular. He not only had a disagreement with South African President Mbeki on that subject, but many South African people themselves took an opposing view on the war in Iraq. And we saw some protests, as we generally see when the president travels to places in Europe, which was quite different than the much warmer reception he received in Botswana.
And tomorrow, what about the central issue of African development? Is the president being challenged by those he's meeting with on the depth and level of Washington's commitment to Africa's economic development, poverty fighting, disease fighting?
I think there's a little bit of holding back, reserving judgment on that question, Tom, because right now all of these leaders are just very pleased to have the American president here. Clearly, whether it's President Mbeki, who may have his disagreements with the president on issues such as how to deal with Zimbabwe, it still is a big, if you will, PR boon for him to receive the president in an official ceremony and be recognized by President Bush. In addition, these leaders are looking to receive a great deal of money from this White House, both in terms of economic aid in the form of the Millennium Challenge account, in which they are required to do something, in which they are required to sort of make some commitment and reforms, democratic reforms, in order to receive aid money. But that money is being prepared to be sent their way if they do that. And then, more importantly, perhaps, they're due to receive their share of $15 billion to fight AIDS, which is the key issue for all of these leaders here in Africa, regardless of their country. Each of these countries has a huge problem fighting AIDS, and they basically need all the help that they can get and are willing to work with the president and his administration's policies and approach on the fight against AIDS in order to get some of that money.
Botswana, of course, has a very high AIDS rate, the highest in Africa. Do the African leaders that President Bush has met with appear confident that that $15 billion is real and that it's actually going to come through?
Well, today the president had perhaps a little bit of a setback in that the House of Representatives, in their initial vote on funding for his AIDS initiative, did not give the White House the full amount of money that the president had requested. So that was perhaps not the best timing for that, as he's trying to convince these leaders that if they're serious, he's serious. But on the other hand, for the president to come here and make this commitment and to seemingly talk the right talk, I think they're all willing to listen.
Tamara Lipper, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Tamara Lipper is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She spoke with us from Pretoria, South Africa. Today, on the third stop of his tour of Africa in Botswana, President Bush reaffirmed a U.S. commitment in the fight against AIDS. Quote, "It doesn't matter what the political party or what the ideology of the American citizen," said the president. "The average citizen cares deeply about the fact that people are dying in record numbers because of HIV/AIDS. We cry for the orphan. We care for the mom who is alone." But is the American government, or maybe just 400 stupendously wealthy Americans, really ready and willing to step up with what Africa needs? And should it? Big picture economist and anti-poverty evangelist Jeffrey Sachs says it's doable if the American government or 400 of the country's wealthiest citizens would make Africa a priority. Do you feel a sense of obligation to the people in Africa? Should rich America open its checkbook and fix Africa? Could it? Should it? Will it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Dublin, Ireland, is Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals. His op-eds in yesterday's New York Times and Los Angeles Times are "A Rich Nation, A Poor Continent," and "If We Cared To, We Could Defeat World Poverty." Good evening and welcome from across the pond, Jeffrey Sachs.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Good to be with you.
Thanks so much for being with us. Also joining me in the studio tonight is tonight's On Point News analyst, Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome, Randall Kennedy.
Thanks so much.
Great to have you here. Jeffrey Sachs, you've got a sassy, modest proposal in our faces as the president swoops around Africa this week. And in it, you make the case that, and I misstated this very slightly in the introduction, you say the 400 wealthiest Americans, as outlined by the IRS, I guess, for the year 2000 tax returns, had an income equivalent to the 166 million inhabitants of four of the countries that President Bush is visiting this week, not five, as I said. And you say this shows a world dangerously out of kilter, and these folks could fix it.
It is unbelievable, actually, to think that the top 400 income earners in the United States in the year 2000 earned $69 billion, according to the IRS report, and that at the very top, the tax rate has been going down for the last decade. What are these individuals doing with that $174 million on average per tax return in the year 2000? Well, one person we know has done something extraordinary. That's Bill Gates. He did give more than $20 billion to the fight against disease in impoverished countries. It's making a huge difference. If the others either were paying that in taxes or were doing it in volunteering some of their income, the evidence is overwhelming that millions of lives could be saved every year. Millions.
Okay, so
millions saved from malaria, from AIDS, from tuberculosis, a tragedy on the continent that is unimaginable to those who have not seen it could be averted.
So it's an immodest, modest proposal, a la Jonathan Swift. And I guess one thing we want to know is this just a kind of interesting thought game on your part, Jeffrey Sachs, or are you serious? Are you saying, hey, rich Americans, step up, you can do this?
Well, I'm absolutely serious. I'd prefer personally that we had not gone through this kind of tax-cutting exercise where we've given hundreds of billions of dollars of income of the budget every year that is needed for social emergencies in the rest of the world and is needed for social emergencies at home. But if we're in a period where the individual is supposed to be responsible, as President Bush tells us, let's see some responsibility of those that can bear it.
Well, maybe we'll see it, and maybe we won't. You say President Bush should step up and encourage people to do this. But you say in another piece in the LA Times that one of the great paradoxes of our times is that while the wealthy world has the resources to fix this problem, it's not doing it. While it's even made explicit promises to step up and fix the problem, they're not being met. And that raised the question in our minds here, Jeffrey Sachs, of what is the reason for that? Is it possible that despite the kind of high moral tone of the president's remarks in Africa today and what you may see in opinion polls or if you asked Americans on the street, that when they really think about it, they don't want to do this or they're not really persuaded of the moral obligation, the practical possibility of doing this? How do you interpret that paradox that the resources are there, but it's not being done despite promises?
I think the first thing is, according to every opinion survey that's been done for years on this particular issue, Americans think that we're vastly more generous than we are. And I think that appeals to the American self-analysis, to the real spirit of compassion in the country. But the belief is simply way off base. I don't think Americans appreciate that our whole aid effort in Africa in recent years has averaged one penny out of every $100 of our income. That's what we're giving, $1 billion of a $10 trillion economy. But when you ask people, what do you think we're giving? Oh, it's 10% of our budget. It's 5% of GNP. It turns out to be orders of magnitude larger than is real.
So,
second, of course, people that don't know the detailed situation think that Africa is one country ruled by thugs, subject to mass corruption, and there's nothing that can be done. And this image of the hopelessness and the self-destruction is the overriding perception in the country. It's simply false. And for those of us who spend a lot of time on a continent of 49 different countries, after all, with the vastly different governments, some of them wonderful and heroic, but without any resources at all to tend to their own needs, because they're impoverished, malarious, far from markets, all the liabilities that they face. This image of the poor deserving their poverty because of their moral corruption, it's a tragedy. It's an easy excuse. It's a huge misunderstanding.
And yet, Randall Kennedy, Jeffrey Sachs, points at it himself. He says, here's the paradox. We can see these things. We can see the need. We can see the resources, and they're not delivered. We want to needle in to the heart of that tonight. Why do you think that these resources aren't flowing to Africa, even though they're there? Do you think that Jeffrey Sachs is right when he says Americans actually feel that we are or should be doing this, or is it maybe more complicated somehow?
Well, I think that he's absolutely – first of all, this is a wonderful intervention on Jeffrey Sachs' part. I think it's a great idea. He's expressing noble sentiments and has thrown down a wonderful challenge.
For everybody out there who's making $175 million plus, the challenge, the gauntlet is down.
Indeed. Now, on the question of why not more, I think that the point needs to be underlined that so many Americans think that we're so much more generous than we are. To read from something Jeffrey Sachs recently wrote, United States foreign aid remains the lowest as a share of income in the entire donor world. 0.1% of GNP in the United States. We're simply not as generous as we think we are. But I do think that there's some other issues as well. For one thing, there are a lot of we're talking about getting rid of or minimizing poverty around the world. We've got poverty in the United States. And I would assume that there's people listening right now who are having difficulty getting health insurance, who are having difficulty getting a job, keeping a job, who are having difficulty paying their bills. And I would assume that some of these people are saying, why are we talking about the continent of Africa, don't we have some things to take care of closer to home?
So, Randall Kennedy, you're a smart guy. You're watching all this go on. You're African-American. If it were in your hands and all that money was sitting there and you could keep it here or send it there, what would you do? Should America bail Africa out?
Americans should certainly want to help Africans. One point here is, who needs it the most? Americans are in a tight situation, some of them, but they're in a great situation compared to the misery that so many Africans face.
I don't hear a clear yes or no there. We may come back and torture you with that question. We're talking tonight about rich continent, a poor continent, Africa, and America's responsibility. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a rich continent, a poor continent, and a modest proposal for America's rich bailing out Africa's poor. It's made by Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and global economic guru, big picture guy. He joins us tonight from Dublin, Ireland, and we're grateful to him for staying up to be with us here in the United States. You can join this conversation as well with Jeffrey Sachs, Randall Kennedy, our news analyst tonight. Do you feel that you have a responsibility to help out Africa? Should Americans pay more to help out poor countries? Why? Exactly why? And should rich Americans open their checkbooks and bail Africa out in the blink of an eye? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeffrey Sachs, I want to come right back to this point because you lay out the paradox. The resources are there, but it's not being done. You explain why you think it's not happening, but complete the logic loop for us. If let's just say that humanitarian impulses alone don't get this done, and it would appear that they don't because Americans have seen the pictures from Africa and still the money's not flowing in the volume that you'd like to see. Make the case for an American sitting out there tonight as to why this money should be taken and poured into Africa.
Let me start by coming back first to the humanitarian impulse because I don't exactly accept the premise. I think Americans are ready to do vastly more. When the president announced an AIDS program, both houses of Congress stood up and gave a standing ovation at the State of the Union. This is not the third rail of American politics, as foreign aid is often called. This is something Americans will do if they're given some proper advice from the leadership. Here's what could happen if this is what's done. Of course, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have cared to talk about this. I think it's been a failure of leadership.
So we grant that, but yet, as you say, it's not happening. It hasn't happened. So it makes us feel we have to push beyond the humanitarian case itself, or at least make it part of a whole cycle here.
Well, there's no doubt that there are many, many reasons for helping. I do believe that the human heart and the humanitarian impulse is the most important, and I actually think it's the one in the end that works. Mm-hmm. But there are many others. The collapse of states has drawn us into more wars in the last 30 years than any other factor. We're talking about intervening in Liberia right now. We're still stuck in Afghanistan. We've got the disaster in Iraq. Do we have to wait till everything explodes all the time before we help countries gain some stability and some foothold into economic development? Do we really believe that it's safe and prudent to let a whole continent run rampant of disease, of malaria, of tuberculosis, of AIDS, and we think this isn't going to affect public health all over the world? Mm-hmm. AIDS is a disease that started in Africa. For 50 years, it wasn't even picked up because there's no healthcare monitoring and system. These countries are so poor. And now it's spread all over the world. And how many other diseases are going to come by letting this fulminant disaster continue in Africa? So I think I start with the human reality that millions of people are dying. We don't and shouldn't believe in that if there's a way to stop it, which there is. But on the other hand, the idea that somehow we can be safe because we're protected by an ocean, this has already been proved disastrously wrong again and again, and of course in the most searing ways in recent years.
Randall Kennedy, here's Jeffrey Sachs once again picking up this torch and saying, by gosh, we can do it. the human heart is the baseline reason why a humanitarian impulse, but there are other reasons too. Global stability, let's get away from chaos, let's look care for global public health. It can go back to bite us. And still, it is an epic scale of goal, of aspiration that he outlines here. And we see the foot dragging that goes on, that goes on, that goes on.
Well, I agree with him completely, but I think we have to confront some challenges. One is the challenge of making very concrete the sort of misery and the sort of problems he's talking about. It's one thing to talk abstractly about people facing tremendous deprivation. I'm not so sure that so many Americans really understand the depth of the deprivation, the consequences that he describes. Also, you know, there's deprivation on people's doorsteps every day. And as I go through Cambridge, for instance, I see people look at homeless people and walk right by. I think we have to figure out concretely and practically how we mobilize people's emotions, their attention, their feelings to actually get something done. That's where I think we need to hear more.
And are you also saying, though, that there's a greater claim on American resources from America's poor?
Well, I think that's a question. I'm sure that there are going to be a lot of people who are going to say, listen, you know, there are millions of Americans that don't have health care. There are millions. There are people in America who are in bad shape. And for that matter, what about people in other parts of the world? I mean, why Africa? The question of priority, I think, really is an issue. I'd like to hear more from Professor Sachs on this.
Jeffrey Sachs, how about it? First of all, this balance between American poor and African poor. And secondly, out of all the world, why Africa?
Well, I think there are many very important needs in the United States. And I do not believe it's either or. I do think that that's the choice that we're confronted with by a right-wing administration that has gutted fiscal policy by cutting taxes by hundreds of billions of dollars a year and then saying, lo and behold, there's no money for education, there's no money for health care. And of course, if you start by taking a budget surplus that was built up carefully and prudently over a decade, and then you launch massive tax cuts, and you say, oh, now we're without resources, that's, of course, what we're going to get. So I think the whole country is on the wrong direction in having given away massive tax cuts to the rich and then turning around and claiming impoverishment and being able to address real issues. I do not believe that this is a choice of America's poor or Africa's poor. Why Africa versus the rest of the world? Because Africa is different. It is dying. It's dying by the millions. And it's true what Randall Kennedy has said. Americans don't understand it. I know because I didn't understand it. I'm a trained, professional, experienced development economist. I've probably seen as much of the world as most certainly. And before I started working in Africa, which was in the mid-1990s, I didn't get it. Because I assumed that someone was looking after malaria, someone was looking after AIDS, and it was only when I started looking into the eyes of dying people that were dying because there wasn't a 15-cent dose of quinine there, mm-hmm. or were dying because they didn't have a dollar to keep them alive that day for the pills, that I started to understand. It took me many years to start to disentangle this because we are surrounded by spin, self-congratulation, and the illusion that whatever afflicts poor people must be their own fault. This is a large part of the ideology in which we live, and we've got to disentangle a lot. My imagination was not good enough until I started going to Africa regularly to understand the real situation.
So if that American gazillion there is sitting there tonight with his or her pen above the checkbook, you're saying millions are dying.
Well, I would say if a gazillionaire is listening tonight, please get on an airplane. Go see it for yourself. You don't have to trust me. Just go have a look. Mm. You will see villages that are basically orphanages now because mothers and fathers have been allowed to die by the millions across Africa. And you will see children that are dying at age 4, age 5, age 6 because they go to the clinic and there's no anti-malarial medicine. Malaria happens to be a completely treatable disease. It also happens that because of Africa's climate, which is unique in the world, they have the kind of mosquitoes and they have the hot temperatures and the humidity that lead to at least a billion cases of malaria a year right now. They've got to be treated. And if the medicine's not there, you very often die of the disease.
Randall Kennedy, it's a giant campaign. Jeffrey Sachs continues to outline here. We were talking just before the show, and you said in some ways it reminded you of the abolitionists a century and a half ago in the 19th century, in the early days of the abolition movement in the United States, abolition of slavery, not poverty.
Indeed, this is remarkable, the indignation I hear, the passion I hear, and also the injustice that has just been outlined does make one mindful of the crusade against slavery in the 19th century. Having said that, one ought to also be reminded of the difficulty of that campaign.
Of getting the people to buy in.
Yes. I mean, it's one thing to identify an injustice. It's another thing to actually mobilize the politics that are the political will that is needed to wrestle that injustice to the ground. But of course, the first thing to do is to identify it and to scream about it and to holler about it and to demand to be heard about it. And that's what Jeffrey Sachs is doing, to his great credit.
It was a decades-long process in the 19th century. Perhaps we're already some way into that cycle on the poverty front in this century.
Let me add one other thing. You know, the abolitionists of the movement that reached fruition in the 19th century, some people think that it was nourished by the wealth of industrial capitalism, that that's what enabled the abolitionist movement to eventually succeed. It's quite possible that the tremendous riches that Jeffrey Sachs is pointing to in today's world might also be the nourishment for this this new abolitionist movement that is directed against the bondage of poverty and the bondage of preventable afflictions.
Well, if 400 Americans have the annual income of 166 million Africans, I say we've reached some kind of magnificent or certainly hugely eye-catching ratio there. I want to turn to our callers. Samoli is calling from Boston. Hi, Samoli. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Good evening.
Good evening. And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am just trying to make a point about what's going on in Africa, because in Africa, we are a very rich continent. We have gold, we have diamond, we have oil. We say thank you very much for the help that America can bring to us, but all we really need are some very good leaders, some low leaders.
The good African leaders, that is.
Some good African leaders.
Somali, where are you from in Africa?
I'm from Madagascar.
And have you seen the kind of leadership that you need there?
No, not at all. I've been to Madagascar. I've been to Senegal, Ivory Coast. Things like that doesn't exist. I can say that over there, all we have are some kind of thugs.
Thugs.
Thugs. That's all. That's all.
Somali, we've got the picture. Thanks for calling in with that. Jeffrey Sachs, what about it? You know, this is what comes up. You put your finger on it yourself earlier in the conversation. People think of giving, and then they think of Mobutu Sese Seko, palaces along Lake Geneva, billions siphoned off, bad leadership, and say, forget it. What's the point?
Isn't it ironic that we gave those billions to Mobutu? Of course, we've played Cold War politics and every other kind of proxy politics in Africa rather than looking at African needs. There are thugs in many places in Africa. I think Zimbabwe really is run by a thugocracy right now. It's time for Mr. Mugabe to go. Secretary Colin Powell was absolutely right about that when he said it. But there are some wonderful governments in Africa. I was in Ghana last week. I'll be going back this coming week. In Tanzania, President Mkapa, and Senegal, President Wade. These are presidents that are struggling with impoverishment. These are presidents that are multi-party democracies trying to make things work. But it's not good enough to be well-governed, apparently. You're just cast with the overall shadow and the overall idea that there is Africa, one country, instead of the 49 separate and distinct countries, some so tragically poor, it wouldn't matter who's governing them. People would be dying willy-nilly. Others that have a chance to lift their heads above poverty if we give them a hand.
So you say I was on
the phone today with President Chissano of Mozambique.
Mm-hmm.
That is a country that has gone from colonial rule to democracy with a president as clear and sharp of trying to get the country educated, to use whatever resources possible to get a country that was at the very bottom of the heap going again. But the president was absolutely clear. They're being crushed by AIDS. They're being crushed by malaria. They're being crushed by the absence of infrastructure. And they're lucky because they're sitting next to South Africa, which is the rich country. But they still need lots of help.
Despite best efforts. Jeffrey Sachs, Randall Kennedy, stand by for just a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation Linda Bilmes. She teaches budgeting and financial management at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and was Assistant Secretary of Management and Budget with the Department of Commerce in the Clinton administration from 98 to 2001. Good evening and welcome, Linda Bilmes.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Linda, we're looking for you to give us a real quick reality check on one big piece of what the president is touting in Africa this week, and that is the $15 billion aimed at AIDS. You have written in the Financial Times out of London just this week that it's not really there, that it's a charade.
Well, I mean, I think that there are two questions really that need to be answered. And the first one is the president is talking about $15 billion, but how much money is really on the table? And the second issue is for what modest resources are actually on the table, how that money goes to Africa, because it's another case of the administration trying to sort of create a way to do it itself rather than using existing international channels.
Well, just today, the House resisted the allocation of money. I mean, there's been a kind of general blessing of this thing, but you're saying it's a year-by-year allocation, and already it's not happening.
Well, what is happening is that the president announced a $15 billion program, $3 billion for 5 years, and Congress authorized this money, $3 billion for 5 years. Now, authorizing means giving permission, like if I give my son permission to use the car.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to actually, what matters is giving him the car keys, which in the budget context is an appropriation.
The annual appropriation.
The annual appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
And the president did not request the $3 billion that he promised. What he requested was $1.9 billion, which is obviously a third less than he could have.
But he's stressing it every day in Africa. Is this a lie, or is he intending to backfill and have more going to Africa in the out years? What's your view?
Well, I think you would have to say that it certainly is at this point an exaggeration or a hope. It's a hope that at some point in the future, that in the out years, the rest of the money is funded. But it is very much on paper. It's very much a paper promise. I think that when you look at what he's actually requesting, the only thing which is a new item of money is a $450 million program at the State Department. And this program would basically give the State Department the ability to administer grants.
So more infrastructure there. Linda Bilmes, thanks for the reality check on that $15 billion front. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're talking tonight about a rich continent, a poor continent, about Africa and America's responsibility. Do you share Jeffrey Sachs' optimism that we have the resources to fix Africa's problems? And what about America's poor? Where do they fit into this picture? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a rich country, a poor continent, and a modest proposal from global economic guru Jeffrey Sachs, that America's rich bail out Africa's poor. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? What do you make of George Bush's gallop through Africa this week? Do you share Jeffrey Sachs' optimism that we have the resources to fix Africa's problems? And if rich Americans should cough up more for Africa, should you too? Are you ready to do it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Carol is calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I live near a train. It's going by.
That's all right.
I just wanted to join the conversation. Thank you very much for including me, and I want to thank Jeffrey Sachs for the work he's doing. I had the opportunity this year to travel to rural El Salvador, and when I returned, I had a lot of trouble telling people about what I saw and what it meant
because
I had never seen poverty like I saw.
So people, it was hard to describe it, or people didn't want to listen to what you had to say?
Well, I was going to tell you a little story. I met some friends for dinner, and the next day was telling somebody at work about it. And I said, I realized when I got home that what the three of us spent for a modest dinner could probably support several Salvadoran families for a month or two.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little silence, and my coworker said, "You don't want to think like that."
Right.
We're consumers. We don't want to think like that. And I think as much as I think it's a good idea for the rich to jump on, I really think that we regular Americans don't get it. And I am very worried that if we don't get it, I don't know if someone who's extremely rich will ever get it.
But isn't this the curse of travel, Carol, that when you come back, whatever you've seen, you get about a 60-second audience before the eyes glaze over? And if it has to do with not going out to dinner, it could be 30 seconds.
Exactly. Right. I agree. But I think if the rich can get on board, that would be wonderful. But I think I don't want the rest of us to get let off the hook.
We got it. Carol, thanks for your call. Jeffrey Sachs, how about it? First of all, the glaze factor. I'm absolutely certain you have seen it. And secondly, in your modest proposal to the rich, are they any less susceptible to the eyes glazing over than a middle-class person who wants to just go out and have dinner?
Well, I want to hear more of Carol's stories, and I think a lot of Americans are interested also. I must say that as I travel around the country, I don't find resistance in so-called conservative communities. I find that people are interested. They're not sure that something can be done. They want to know, will our money be wasted? But the so-called average Americans, I think, are very generous. The question is whether the rich and the super rich are as generous. I suppose that they could be, understanding the situation. I'd like to point out, by the way, the difference of the super rich and the rich, because this burden should not fall mainly on the working class Americans who are asking, how can I even meet my bills? And now he's asking to bail out Africa. Is he crazy?
Right.
What the IRS showed us is not only did the top 400 income earners have $69 billion of income, an average of $174 million the year 2000, but the total income of those that filed returns of more than $200,000, that's pretty good, more than $200,000, that adds up to $1.8 trillion of income. So if you were to ask the income earners above $200,000 to give 1% of their income, that's 1% of $1.7 trillion, or $17 billion. In other words, we really do have to ask the high end of our society, come on, do you want to pay taxes as you should be paying more? If you're not paying taxes, why aren't you stepping up to help solve these problems on a voluntary basis?
And
the fact of the matter is, America has become so unequal in its income distribution. The very rich have gotten not just a free ride, but they've gotten massive tax cuts in the last 20 years as the working class has gotten squeezed. And we have to face up to this basic fact in our own country as well.
And if they did it, if the rich and the well-to-do did that, what would the impact be? I mean, would Africa suddenly look like Southern California? What are we talking about here?
No way. And that's actually not the point. And it's a very important point. As I understand economic development, it really is climbing a ladder. The ladder is one rung at a time, even one generation at a time. Parents helping their children get a better education. Their children, children helping their children get a better education, learn skills, become part of a more productive global society.
But how far up the ladder would these 400 checkbooks, if they're scratching out checks right now, how far would they bump Africa?
What they would do, in my view, is help get the first foot on the ladder. Africa's not even on the ladder right now. The ladder's off the ground. They can't even reach the first rung. They're dying below the ladder. They're hungry. They're starving. They're suffering from AIDS, malaria, TB, diarrheal disease, respiratory infection, mothers dying of childbirth, a million children dying of measles. So the point here is to just get on the ladder. It's not that America's going to make Africa rich. But Africa's not even achieving economic development right now. It's falling backwards. It's to help Africa get the foot on the ladder. Then, like all societies in the world, these societies are going to, in the end, they're going to be responsible for their own fate, largely. But if they can't even get started, then the disaster is not only their disaster, it's also our disaster.
Andrew's calling from Cold Spring, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling because I'm so moved by Dr. Sacks, someone who's so intellectually gifted but can talk from the heart. And God help those who can't understand the talk from the heart, but let's talk to them in economic terms. Well, as Dr. Sacks said, they're not even on the ladder, but what could Africa be? What will our companies do when we all own cell phones, two cars, PCs? Where will we expand our markets? Well, there's a potential rich continent there, but if we let them die, shame on us. And it'll be to our economic detriment. For those who can't understand Dr. Sacks' heart, understand the economic argument. It's in our best interest in the long run to help Africa achieve at least self-sustainability, and hopefully more than that.
Andrew, thanks for your call and for your emotive response to Jeffrey Sacks. Jeffrey Sacks, what about that? I mean, is the goal to turn Africa into a vast new market for American companies, or is that where the world's headed in your view?
Well, I say bravo to Andrew also for reminding me I'm an economist, which is that we invested in Europe at the end of the Second World War. General George Marshall, one of our greatest leaders, came to Harvard in 1947 at the commencement address and said, we can't just let Europe wallow in this chaos. Not only will the chaos spread, but we'll lose our own benefits in the future. We launched the Marshall Plan. Winston Churchill famously called it the most unsorted act in human history. The payoffs have been phenomenal for our own security, but as Andrew said, also for our economy. We have found a partner. We found a partner to trade with investment and so on. I don't think we're going to have huge returns from Africa for quite a long time. This is not basically a direct economic self-interest in the sense of the markets, although there's potential there, of course. But Andrew's vision that Africa will join the rest of the world as productive members of a global economy, that's absolutely right. And for the longer term, there's no doubt that there's an economic benefit, but trade is a mutual benefit, an economic benefit for us. But the immediate benefits for us, not just for saving millions of lives, but for us in terms of fewer Liberias, fewer Somalias, fewer disasters of AIDS and other emerging diseases spreading to our shores. Those are very real, and those are going to come much quicker.
Jeffrey Sacks, our time is growing very short now. Let me ask you two things. One, have you talked with rich Americans who have taken a step like this? Ted Turner opened his checkbook and made out a big check to the United Nations. Bill Gates has committed to $20 billion. Have they done it? And do they feel emboldened or disillusioned? Or what do you know? You run with these guys.
Well, I've, of course, talked to Bill Gates many times. I think he has done more individually to reinvigorate global public health than any person in the world. It's been absolutely phenomenal. And I think he's reaping lots of personal rewards, the satisfaction of knowing that lives are being saved and millions of lives are being saved as a result of what he and Melinda Gates have done. I know I spent a lot of time with Ray Gilmartin, CEO of Merck, in recent years, helping Merck and working with Merck and encouraging Merck to give its drugs at zero profit, that is, at cost to Africa to help fight AIDS. And Merck did that. It made a major contribution to initiating treatment programs in Botswana, one of the president's stops. And when I spoke recently with Rego Martin, he said that what this did to the spirit of the company internally, to the morale, to the sense of belonging, not to a corporation only out to make bucks, but to a corporation that had technologies that could help service the world, he said that it was a most incredibly bracing and galvanizing effect internally for the company. Well, bravo, because we do have great technologies in the United States. Mm. Those drugs are amazing drugs. They just haven't reached Africa yet.
And let me ask you this. As you watch George Bush making his five-country tour of Africa this week, how do you interpret the motivation, the strategy, the campaign that's being acted out before our eyes here?
I'm just hoping that the president really sees something, that it's not just enveloped in spin. We live at a time where the White House is our greatest spin machine, and if the president goes in a cocoon and comes back in a cocoon not having seen the realities, it will be a tragedy.
Isn't that almost inevitable, given the – you know what it's like when presidents travel. Is he really going to come face-to-face with the poverty you describe as life and death and mostly death?
If he sees people that are dying because they don't have medicines, it's a life-changing reality. And I don't know whether he'll be so protected from that that he'll have – come and gone without seeing the reality of 30 million Africans HIV infected that do not have access to these drugs, and the millions that urgently need it to stay alive right now, or whether he'll see it, because I know congressmen and senators, pretty tough ones often, that go see it, and it does change their lives, and I'm hoping that this is going to happen with the president as well.
Let's get one more call. David is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. A question for you.
Yes.
If I'm interested in donating money to a fund somewhere that helps to alleviate disease in Africa,
all right,
how would I do it?
Well, we've got the answer man for that, Jeffrey Sachs.
Well, the easiest and most direct way, the way that I believe in, is to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, www.globalfundatm.org. This is the international body that Kofi Annan championed, started up, whose direct mission is to get help to countries to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And I think it's a remarkable institution. It's gotten from nowhere to now, with about supporting about 80 programs around the world, 80 countries around the world in the fight against these three killer diseases. And I think it's a remarkable institution that is absolutely worthy of our great support. I just wish the White House would give it some support.
Jeffrey Sachs, you're a good soul to stay up to this hour with us from Dublin, Ireland. We thank you very much for joining us tonight. And
wonderful.
And keep it up.
With you.
Thanks for joining us. Good night. Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and author of op-eds in the New York Times and Los Angeles Times this week, including in the LA Times. If we cared to, we could defeat world poverty. Well, Randall Kennedy, I don't know. I heard you as a little bit of a skeptic as we opened up this conversation about this hour tonight. How are you feeling at the end of this conversation?
Well, I'm skeptical, but I'd like to end by saying that Jeff Sachs has voiced a visionary protest and really posited a remarkable and just demand on America's super rich and on American society as a whole. And one can only hope that he gets some traction.
Here's a hope for that. Randall Kennedy, thanks so much for being with us tonight. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoke, with help from Julie Diop. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.